Dear friends, in this weekly study of this wonderful scripture, which is universal in its nature and very philosophical, at the same time immensely poetical and very practical too, it helps us to practice the spiritual discipline in everyday life. It is not that it gives us only a few ideas about afterlife or the prayers or meditations, but how every moment of our life could be attuned to the great ideal that is presented by Bhagavad Gita before us. The ideal is important. A human life is lived for a cause, for a purpose. Everything has to have a purpose, and the whole life therefore is tuned to a purpose, geared to the purpose. And the purpose of life has been shown as realizing one's true nature, because that is the source of everything that we really are seeking. So therefore that becomes the goal. Another very special feature of Bhagavad Gita, in fact of all the texts that we study in Vedanta, is that they are presented very rationally. There is no contradiction between reason and the religion. That we can see here. Arjuna asks very pertinent questions and then gets the answers for them. Arjuna, the disciple, is representing all of us, and thus we can resonate our minds to the questions asked by him. And there we see that Bhagavad Gita presents a goal that is based on what we really are seeking. It is not a goal that is just told by these sages, but this is, if we analyze, is what we all are actually seeking in our lives, and therefore that becomes the goal of life. So where do we find all that we are seeking? The answer is very simple and yet sounds very complicated, very difficult to fathom, because what we are seeking is really very easy to get. What is easier to get by us than ourselves? It is the simplest thing to get. You don't need to go anywhere. You don't need to depend on anybody else. If you want to get something else, you have to depend on something, means that thing should be available there. You should have the money to buy it, and so forth. There are many constraints if we need something from somebody else. But our true selves, then, well, it is not to be obtained from outside. There is nobody else that is going to restrict us from getting it. We can therefore get it, easiest thing to get, and yet it is most difficult because of the ignorance about it, because of the tendencies that we have developed over not only years, not only decades, but for many births together, and that is to get pleasures from outside, get whatever we want fulfilled from some source outside. And thus it is difficult to stop that momentum, and therefore we feel it is so difficult even to understand and practice. Rationally to understand is not very difficult. But then since we still keep on feeling, well, the world around me is real, there is so much pleasure that I can get from all those things, and thus what is this idea that all happiness is really within me and that is the goal of life, sounds not easily appreciable. As I was telling that one of our devotees mentions all the time that, Swami, it makes sense here, but does not make sense here. It is rationally understanding is easy, but that is just a small part of what really motivates and governs our lives. And therefore, although simple theoretically, practically it becomes very difficult. Many things on paper seem to be very easy, that the idea of having this construction there. So on paper it appears simple, okay, yes, yes, what we need is just two halls and this and that. But then when you actually try to implement it, many, many, many difficulties keep on cropping up one after another. So this is true about the building of our lives too. It is simple, deceptively simple, that yes, what we want to realize is our true self. Just know who am I and done. It is done. Job is done. Just know who am I. And it looks simple, but try that and one will see so many problems that we have about knowing who am I. And not only knowing intellectually, it may be just the first step, experiencing it. So Bhagavad Gita gives illumination on all the both sides, that one has to intellectually appreciate, understand and fathom all the conclusions of it. But more importantly, it is a matter of experience that has to be converted into experience. What we understand is one part of it. Then that understanding is to be converted into tangible, practical experience. Knowing about mountaineering and all, how one climbs on the all these mountains, knowing one thing, but then actually climbing, then ask that Nancy sitting there, that how many things, how much practice is needed, how much that physical capabilities are required to do that. It's not very easy. If you start panting just by climbing 50 feet or 100 feet, one needs lot of preparation to climb and sustain oneself at the heights like 20,000 feet. So on paper it is simple, just as you climb one step, climb the next step, climb the next step, keep on doing that. But practically, well, it is very difficult. In everything it's like that, that you read a nice book on swimming, maybe in an hour or so you will be able to finish and understand that book. What do you need to do? Is it enough to become Michael Phelps? Certainly not. You need to do much harder work for that. Discipline your lives to a great extent to achieve that. So it is a combination of both that one has to see, understand and implement. So understanding is called in Bhagavad Gita Brahma Vidya, and implementation, practically transforming our lives to manifest that understanding, and that is called yoga. Yoga is that. So, in the 12th chapter that we began, there is a confusion in the mind of Arjuna that he expresses. Not exactly a confusion, but this is a commonly seen psychological tendency as to our funny feeling about something is superior, something is inferior. And for most of us, the idea that there is this one continuous self, all pervading one reality, that idea is very enchanting. And the devotion to a personal God sounds to be difficult. The God who is creator, the God from whom this everything has sprung up, and the God who bestows grace, devotion to that God appears to be an inferior path, maybe a path, but not a really superior path. But there is nothing superior or inferior. It is what is helpful to us. That is what we should take up. There is no superior or inferior medication. That which cures you is good for you. And that is the same applicable here too. Whatever is going to elevate your life towards ideal, that is the right path for you, that is the most superior path for you. So Arjuna asked this question that we were seeing in the beginning of the 12th chapter, that it is two paths have been told by you, but I am a little bit confused. Tell me which is superior in your opinion. Evam satata yuktaye bhaktastvam pariupasate ye chapyaksharam avyaktam tesham ke yoga vittamah. Arjuna said, between those devotees who worship you, being thus ever devoted, and those who worship the imperishable, the unmanifest, who are the better versed in yoga? The idea is that which is better, the path, those who are better versed, I will join them. Nobody ever likes to follow a path that sounds to be inferior. This is a psychology. This is not logic, friends. Logic and psychologic are not same thing. So, psychologically we feel that why should I go for something inferior? I will go for the best one, the superior one. It is in the shops, therefore, they tell you this is the best product. Every product that is on the shop, nobody says that this is inferior. Everything is best. Every book is bestseller. Americans are very good with the selling techniques. So in India back there, I found one book, and it was written there, the bestseller. I thought, wow, wonderful book, or bestseller book, so must be a great book. And then I found, I read that book, not very good, but okay. Then I found another book, again bestseller, American book. Then One of my professors told me, you know, in America only bestsellers are published. There is no book that is not a bestseller. So then, because that is how you dwell on the minds of the buyers, that it is best means I like to get it. It is a little inferior, I don't care for it. So everything that you are given is best. So Arjuna is wanting to know which is superior so that I can follow it. And now let us see Lord Krishna's answer to this question. In last class we discussed the question basically to some extent. I repeated that because we need to really feel the psychology behind this question so that the answer could be properly understood. Arjuna really is like most of us, are not immediately capable of feeling the absolute, unmanifested, formless reality. Intellectually we form some idea, but really having a feel for it is very, very difficult for most of the population. And therefore you will see that monotheism appeals to most people automatically because there is a personal connection. God and me, I and my God. Easily you can form a bond, and thus you can then develop this connection. As it develops more and more, you automatically then start realizing the true nature of the divine too. So therefore, Lord tells that he does not want to say that Arjuna something is superior, but not for you, because that will make Arjuna feel rather morose and sulky, and so therefore he doesn't say that. He tells that, you know, those mayavesha mano yemam nitya yukta upasate shraddhaya parayopeta te me yukta tamamata. The Blessed Lord said, those who worship me, fixing their mind on me, ever devoted and endowed with supreme faith, them I regard as the best yogis. Best, the Arjuna then gets the inclination to practice it, because that is what is needed by Arjuna, like most of us. The talk of all pervading reality, and that is fine, but can you make connection with that? And Lord tells the reason for that too in the next verse. He tells, what about then the other devotees who admire you as all-pervading reality? He tells about them too. Yetvaksharamanirdeshyam avyaktam paryupasate sarvatragamachintyam cha kutasthamachalam dhruvam. He begins the description with this. What it means is, they who worship the imperishable, the indescribable, the unmanifest, all-pervading, inconceivable, changeless, those, he will continue, we will see that as we progress, that they of course are one with me. And so he doesn't call them inferior, but to the devotees, that maya vesha mano yemam, those who worship me, fixing their mind on me. Me here is written in capital because it is Lord. Lord is speaking. So Lord, the I of Lord is not like the common ego. As the Lord sees that everything is really His presence. So there is a difference between that our ego and that universal I. So Lord says that those whose minds are fixed on me, the mind is fixed on the Lord as the goal, then always connected with God, always connected with Lord, and ever devoted and endowed with supreme faith. That there, these are all very important characteristics of a devotee. That a devotee means all these things in life coming together. That fixing the mind on God. Why? Because the love is now directed to God. Whatever you want most, whatever brings joy to you most, that thing you automatically love most. And then whether you are consciously trying or not trying, the mind goes to that object. It keeps on going to it. I was observing recently, I had gone to one place. There we had a nice group and we were discussing many things. And while the philosophical discussions were going on, there were many nice edible things, sweets and all, they were kept outside there. And a little child was on the lap of its mother or father, I don't exactly remember, maybe for some time or with mother or sometime with father. What was happening was, again and again the child's sight was going towards the candies kept there. The other things were there, but the mind was always going there, because that was for the child the source of happiness. And therefore, it always was thinking about it. So, for the devotees of God, God is the source of all happiness. And thus, the mind automatically goes to that. Now, this is practiced in the reverse way, and that is to inculcate that kind of love. That you consciously try to put your minds there. And thus, once you get the taste, then automatically the mind will keep on going there. As they say of a man who used to drink a lot, and then, and drink here does not mean drinking water, you know that it is. So, one of his friends decided to dissuade him from that, it's bad habit and no, it's not right. And then so he went and told him, hey, why you are doing that? Give it up, that's not good. And this fellow said that, have you ever tasted? I said, no, I have never. Then, you know, you first taste it, you take it, and then after taking it, if you still continue to say that you shouldn't take it, then I can think about that. And thus they went to a bar, and then first this advisor friend just took a little sip. Then a little more. Then next day he told his friend that now if you want to give it up you may, but I am not going to give up. They don't think that I am here advocating that drinking. The moral of the story is important, that it is that once you take it consciously, in fact by force, then it is you are not really looking for it at that time, but somehow or other you are put into it. Now you get the taste. Now you don't need to be forced. Another nice example is given is that there is a jaundice-like disease, or it is called jaundice too. And in traditional this Indian medicine, the medication for jaundice is sugar candy. Sugar candy is given to a patient of jaundice. Now the problem with the jaundice patient is that because of the dysfunctional liver and the all the test buds all coated with that that bile, sugar doesn't taste sweet. It tastes like something like ash. And naturally, the person doesn't want to eat sugar. The person doesn't want to eat sugar at all. But it is the medication. So that person is either by self-discipline or if it is child by force, has to be fed with sugar. Now at that time, it is a discipline. To be done conscientiously, to be done with effort to eat sugar. Now sugar as it goes in, what happens now? It is, remember, it is medication. Now that disease starts getting cured. As the disease starts getting cured, what will be the effect? Sugar will start tasting sweet. Now this person will not need to be told, hey, eat sugar, have you taken your dose of sugar? The fellow will automatically take sugar, only will have to be told, hey, don't take too much. That's all. It is like that with devotion too, that once, because the mind is too habituated to seek pleasure from the other worldly objects, is not is kind of diseased mind. The mind is sick, and we feel this sometimes, that sickness comes to us. Why there is so much frustration, so much anger, so much jealousy, many things that we don't want. How do they come in life? Is it not disease? This is, you break the word, then you know the meaning of this word. You are not at ease, that is disease. When you are at ease, it is not disease. So, get that feel that you are not at ease. When the mind is full of jealousy, is it at ease? No. When it is full of frustration, is it at ease? It is not. When some intense passion is there for something outside, is it at ease? It's not. So, all this is the sign of disease. And what is the medication for that? The problem, why is it a disease? Because what you are really seeking is not in those objects. And yet again and again you go and get it, try to get it. And thus the frustration comes. The nice example that I have given many times, and that if you stand in front of the mirror and see that there is a smudge on your forehead. You see it on the in the mirror. But now if you take a towel and start rubbing the mirror to get rid of that smudge, will it go? It will not. You keep on rubbing the mirror, you will get tired, but that smudge will not go. You will feel frustrated. Similarly, And we want to do things out there on the world, to get that smudge removed. It never gets done. But simple thing, rub it out from here, and it gets corrected in the mirror as well. So, first it is difficult to convince that fellow that no, it is not there. You have to turn your hand here and then do it. But because the person is seeing it there, and seeing is believing for us. Oh, it is there. Why? This idea, you know, our experience is so intense that anything contrary to it, howsoever rational it may be, doesn't appeal quickly. I remember an incident in our dispensary that used to go to village. People were mostly illiterate and yet wise people. One lady, she used to come there fairly elderly, and as it happens with age, the joints start giving pain, especially the knees. So she came with the pain in the knee, and then the doctor decided to give her a shot of calcium, because the lack of calcium many times causes those things. So now the assistant, he gave her the shot in this that arm, the muscle in the arm, as it is the case, usually done, held her arm and then pushed the medication. And she came angry, very perturbed, and complained to the doctor, "I was telling that fellow repeatedly that my knee is having the pain, and he put that shot here. Now, how will that work? My knee has the pain. Why now the medication has gone into the arm?" And she was not ready to listen. And then I told her, "Look, you know, where do you feel your hunger? You feel hungry in the stomach, is it not?" "Yes." "But then do you cut stomach and put food there? You put it in the mouth. Does it not work?" So exactly like that. So it is difficult to convince that when you have an experience that the pain is here and medication is here, how will it work? So these our ideas that the pleasures are outside, and therefore we develop love for outside. And we know that love therefore keeps on shifting because the expectations are not met there. So the solution is, well, go to God and go to the Lord who is your true nature. Go to God. There your expectations will be fulfilled. Devote yourself to Lord. Pour all love on God. Now in the beginning, you have to do it with discipline. That discipline is very important. Just as for medicine, if you need a medication, there is a discipline for it. That three pills every day at a given time regularly has to be taken. My doctor asked me, he gave me some pills for reducing cholesterol and something, and then no change really took place. And so he asked that, "Did you take the medicine?" I told that, well, I was very regular about it. So it doesn't work. It works only a little bit. So one has to be regular with the spiritual disciplines to begin with, the devotional practices and all that. So, but as you develop that, then you get the taste of it. You feel the benefit of it. As you feel the benefit of it, you start doing it on your own. You don't need to be told then that, hey, come on, did you practice your meditations, your devotions today or not? You don't need to be thinking about it, because automatically you will do, because you have developed the taste for it. So constantly that thought of Lord will be there. So he says, Nitya Yukta, that ever devoted, not devotion today, not tomorrow, ever devoted. Always the devotion is to God and endowed with supreme faith. What is this supreme faith? Supreme faith, the word, Sanskrit word is Shraddhaya. And Shraddha, there is no proper English word for that, really speaking. Even likes of Swami Vivekananda, he preferred not therefore to translate it. He mentions that I have not come across any word that could really represent this meaning of Shraddha here. It is a faith which is not only believing, but something that makes you dynamically motivated to get it. As Sri Ramakrishna used to give example, a very important, nice example, that suppose a thief has Shraddha, that dynamic true faith, that there is lot of gold and precious stones and cash and big booty kept in the next room. Now the thief, if the fellow is really a thief, will not be able to rest till that booty is all stolen. Will keep on thinking, how can I make a hole in the wall, how can I get all that money, will keep on scheming, when should I do it, and so forth. Always the mind will be thinking of that, that will keep on motivating that person for action continuously. If our Sam knows that there is lot of money there, since he is not a thief, nothing will happen. Okay, let it be. I don't care. But if a thief knows, it will be a different thing. So, similarly, if someone just knows, who has nothing to do with God, that there is God, okay, what does it matter? Do you believe? Oh, okay, I believe. But question is, does it bring any change in your life? Most of us are just believers like that. And that, okay, yes, I believe. How does that belief translate in your life? What difference does it make to your life if you are a believer or a non-believer? Does it make any difference to your life? You may just nod your head one way or the other. Though if you believe, yes, I believe. Or you may say, I don't believe. It is only the movement of head that is the difference. Otherwise, the life goes in the same way. So the belief really didn't become a dynamic, transforming force in life. But Shraddha means that you believe in such, then that belief transforms the life. That is what is called Shraddha. So when that belief therefore doesn't get then shaken by little things happening here and there. Ordinary people's belief, if some problem came in life, some serious tragedy took place in the family, then the belief gets shaken. Why God did this to me? I don't want that God. It is a problem that in one of the interfaith conferences here in the, mostly the medical professionals were there. Happened in the Miriam Hospital here, and one of the questions that was asked by the professionals was this, that when certain these deaths and all happen, the patient comes there, not that everybody is cured and goes home happy. Some breathe last there or do not get properly cured as the patient and their relatives expected. And thus they vent their anger on God, that why God did this to me. And how do we console them that why God did this? And then I suggested that, look, one good thing is that they are venting anger on God, so you guys are safe, you are spared. Let them vent anger on God, that's fine. So second thing is that means they believe in God. To some level they have, how can they vent anger on something non-existent, something they don't believe? And so they have some faith, some belief in God, therefore they are venting anger on God. That's better. So that shakes faith and the spiritual inclinations in the mind, or the religious practices that one is doing. What's the use of all this? I have been praying, I had been offering my worship, I had been also very regular in going to my place of worship, like a church or a temple or whatever, a mosque. I had been quite regular about it. And still, why did this happen to me? It's all meaningless. It's all useless. I won't do any such thing. But although an ordinary devotee gets disturbed by it, this devotee has a true faith in God because this devotee believes that whatever God does is good for him. That is a great step, friends. Whatever the God brings to me is good for me. I crave for something, that is one thing. But what I crave need not always be good for me. God knows better than I know. And so he gives me what is the right, more beneficial for me. It's like the little kids, you know, that they want many things, cry for many things. And then when the parents still refuse to give, then the little fellow becomes very angry. Does not respect the parents. Not only that, says that, well, thinks that the parents are the worst people in the world. It is that feeling comes that why do they not understand that I want this? I had been seeking this. This is all I wanted. At that time, the little kid, the mind is so obsessed by that. Maybe just a candy. This is all I care for. This is all I wanted. And why my parents are not giving me to their monsters? It is that feel comes about the parents too. But the parents know better many times that this thing, although the little one is asking, doesn't know the bad effects of it. And therefore, although the kid is asking, they refuse to give it to the kid. So similarly, this God knows what is to be given. And this devotee understands that, calmly accepts whatever is given by God as the right thing for me. God knows better than I know. So whatever God does is certainly good for me. And thus his faith in God doesn't get vitiated by these ups and downs in the worldly life. The life is full of ups and downs, like the stocks, you know, sir, especially you see these days going up, going down. continuously that's happening. So the life also is like that. Someday elation, hey, good news. Sometimes not so good news. So it goes through all these phases. But the devotion to God for this person remains same. And so it is called with the supreme, endowed with supreme faith. Them I regard as the best yogis. Means now Arjuna should feel that what he has is the best. So psychologically he feels that, well, this path that Lord has told me to follow is really good for me. It is the best path. So we'll not get that complex, that I am told to follow this, but that is the superior path. A little kid, because of his, you know, that he was put to some higher class, but then wasn't doing that good there, and so he has been given a different, less intense course, so that it will be good for his improvement. He is suitable for that. But then that kid immediately understood that this is a lower thing and so said, I don't want to go there because it is lower. Anything that is inferior or lower, I don't want that. I want superior. Whether you are one is capable or not is a different thing. But Arjuna therefore is told, oh, that is this, they are the supreme devotees, they are the best yogis, I love them most. And so he exhorted Arjuna to follow this path, and then comes to tell that the others too are those who follow the path of the imperishable, indescribable, all-pervading, formless, infinite reality. They are also united with me, but that requires proper transformation of life to know that, and it will be described in the coming verses that what are those characteristics, why most of us have to follow this path and not the other one, although other path may appear to be very enchanting. I was victim of that feeling myself, that it appears to be so nice, God is in me, everything is God, there is no other thing in the world, and nice feeling. So I thought that is the wonderful path. But I discovered that that does not really become the reality unless you can connect with it. You need a connector. You need something to join to it. It is, we need a staircase, you know, to go from one floor to another floor. It would be a good idea if we can just jump. Is it not like a monkey? Oh, jump there. But if we cannot, and yet we feel that we can do it, and keep on jumping, no, I want the superior path, I will not take the inferior path of a staircase, I will just jump to the next floor, the result is that you will never get there. So, you are not a monkey, you cannot jump 25 feet like that. So it is, you then, if you don't take staircase, the result will be you just remain where you are. Is it beneficial? Is it what you are looking for? The answer will come as no. So we shall continue to look at these beautiful ideas by the grace of God. So any questions? Yes, George?
All that you say is correct, but unless grace comes, nothing can happen. And grace only comes from God. And God says, I think it's in the Gita, I save who I want, and I destroy who I want.
No.
No?
No. It is I save whom I want and destroy whom I want. No, that's not there. But it is, this part is true, what you said, that...
Well, you can break it back to try to get the light, but if his grace doesn't come, you're not going to get it.
Yes. So, when it comes, you say that you got it by grace, because... See, the beautiful idea is, it is the destruction of ego.
Yeah,
there is no...
I can't disagree with you.
So, it, destruction of ego, then you didn't get it, it came as grace. Because you are not there. So, it is a practice, therefore, to reduce the ego. And the grace of God, therefore, comes... A very beautiful analogy is given by Sri Ramakrishna, that the breeze of Lord's grace is blowing all the time. Now you unfurl your sail so that you get it. The air has been there always, but you have to breathe it. You don't say that let God breathe like that. God has given you the air. Now you breathe it. So that is about the grace, that it is there, you have to unfurl your sail to get that breeze. So that is the how one makes oneself kind of eligible. I know there are logical contradictions involved in it. It cannot therefore be really explained fully on the basis of rationality. Because if you say that grace also has conditions, then it is not grace. If you do this and you get grace, then it is something that is in your power.
Well, all you can say is, I'll do my best to get enlightenment, but if it doesn't come...
Exactly, that is what you can do. Another disciple of Sri Ramakrishna gave a beautiful analogy. That it is in your power when you want to get a job, you keep on applying, you keep on sending your resume and all that. And that is your part.
Yeah, right.
But that the employer has to give you employment.
Right.
That is the grace. You see, that if whatever that employer chooses, that is that employer's call. Your job is to send the resume, send the application. Do you say that I won't send the applications, I won't send resume, it all depends on the grace of the employer? You don't. You keep on doing your part of it. Whether you get it or not, so many contractors presented their quotes here when they wanted that job. They wanted it. But just because they had submitted their proposals, their quotes, doesn't mean that all of them are going to get it. Only one is going to get the job. So, who gets it? Whosoever is considered most suitable, and that is the call of the one who gives the contract. So, therefore, here too, you do your prayers and just patiently wait. And the grace will come.
Right. It's like in AA, I like to go to the meetings.
Yes, yes, yes.
But I like to hear what they say.
It is very good. Their book also I read and has many of these principles very beautifully. Yes,
but,
very good.
But the thing is it says the biggest disappointment for a lot of people that run it and work hard is to break their heart when they see a guy trying like everything and he still can't get over it.
That is true. It is it is true because habits die hard, friends. We don't know how deep has the habit gone and how, at what level the attempt is getting made. It is at our this worldliness has also, this sickness due to worldliness has also gone at different levels of depth. So it depends on how deep it has gone, and thus at what level the medication needs to be taken, and how long do we have to take it, that all is dependent on that. Okay, then we shall conclude with the closing prayers. Gita Sugita Kartavya Kimanyat Shastra Vistarehi Yasvayam Padmanabhasya Mukhapadmadvinesvita Ekam Shastram Devaki Putra Gitam Eko Devo Devaki Putra Eva Eko Mantra Tasya Namani Yani Karma Pekam Tasya Devasya Seva Shri Krishna Arpanamastu. One quick announcement, friends. This coming Sunday, the Sunday service talk at 5 o'clock will be given by Dr. Kumar Murthy, one of the greatest mathematicians of our times from University of Toronto. Of course, that is not the reason that we have invited him to speak here, but he is also a very dedicated student and practitioner of Vedanta. So he has spoken here quite a few times and a wonderful speaker. His talk is usually always laced with lot of humor too, and so please try to come. He will be speaking on thank you. Thank you, friends.